You're listening to the Lean Built Podcast. I'm Jay.
And I'm Andrew. In this podcast, we discuss our manufacturing companies, lean principles,
and the freedom that we're pursuing in life and business.
In talking with Jay, he asked if the eclipse was awesome where I was, and it absolutely was. We took a week off from the podcast. Jay was on vacation. I was traveling for work, and I was scheduled to fly from Dallas back to Indianapolis on eclipse day.
No.
And so I was flying from an eclipse area to another eclipse area on eclipse day.
Okay. Were your tickets sky high?
No, I bought them months and months and months before.
Okay.
I might have bought them as much as nearly a year ahead of time.
So it wasn't like an eclipse flight where you were—
No. Okay. It was just, I had no idea back when I booked those tickets. It was not on my radar.
Yeah.
And so I got to the Dallas airport Monday morning. It was busy. People were flying in to see the eclipse.
Yep.
And then I was flying to Indianapolis, which was going to be right in the totality, path of totality. And then I live a little over an hour south of the airport in Bloomington. The path of totality was less than half a mile from my house.
Oh my gosh.
Like just dead center. And the weather was supposed to be really nice. It was supposed to be cloudy in Texas.
Yes.
But clear in Indiana. And so there were people flying out of Dallas. We stopped in Kansas City and picked up a whole bunch of people who were just flying from Kansas City to Indy for the eclipse, turning right around and flying back, not even spending the night.
Yeah.
And so I fully expected it to be an absolute zoo when I got to Indianapolis. I had traveled for the Rangemaster Tactical Conference down in Dallas at Dallas Pistol Club, which was excellent. Really enjoyed it. But I flew carry-on only. I wanted to be light and fast. I wanted to get back to the Indy airport and not wait at baggage claim and just jet out of there. I'd left my little orange car parked at an offsite parking lot.
Econo lot.
A shuttle, so, grab the car, get out of there.
Yep.
And I expected it to just be a zoo. I got to the airport. It was busy, but not crazy. I got downstairs. The shuttle was waiting. I hopped the shuttle. I was the last one on. We booked it to the car park. I got dropped off first out of everybody in the entire shuttle at my vehicle, got in my car, hit the highway, and made it back home in an hour flat.
Wow. Oh,
and there was nobody on the highways. The highways were less busy than a normal weekday.
Because everyone's pulled over. They're looking up. They got their glasses on.
Nobody was pulled over. There was nobody on the highway. The highways
were empty. Because they're at their viewing spot, essentially.
Yeah, probably. But wow. I got home an hour before the totality from my multi-day business trip, dropped my stuff off, went inside, sat down with my kids on our back porch, on our porch swing, put glasses on, and watched the totality from my back porch.
I am so jealous. I'm a space junkie, first of all. Like,
it was awesome.
Outside of the office Lego set, all the Legos that I've built as an adult are space related. Is that true? No, I think there's a car in there somewhere. But
everybody's got to have a pirate ship.
So yeah, of course. So what I knew about this probably years in advance, because the last total one was in 2017. I'm like, when is the next one? It's in 2024. I'm booking it, getting ready. So I was looking at tickets like last October or November. So Manny, office manager, doesn't work in the office. He's in San Antonio, Texas. So I said, hey, Manny, I might be out the weekend of the April 8th, the eclipse. I'll probably bring the family because I want the boys to experience it. We'd like to meet up with you because I am not going to travel the day before or the day after. We'll make a little mini trip out to go see the Alamo, all that good stuff. We used to live in Austin too, so we're familiar with that part of Texas. And then you started seeing the gouging happen. So a regular flight, like a Southwest flight that may have been sub $200 is suddenly $400. All the Airbnbs are gouged. I did find an Airbnb that was actually a boat docked on a lake, which would have been cool. But I just thought, I don't know about this one. Let me keep looking. And then I thought, what if we go out there and the weather is crummy? I'm going to be so frustrated personally. And
come to visit us in Indiana.
I wish I would have brought it up, honestly, because our families could have met each other and stuff like that.
If you had tried to schedule a visit on the day I was flying back from a multi-day conference, I would have just said no.
You would have said no. It's understood. Yeah.
Reasonably.
I didn't even think that. And I'm like, well, you know what? There's social media between 2017 and 2024 is probably doubled, I'm going to say. So I will catch it virtually. And honestly, it came and went. And I have not sought out any social media to see what it looked like.
I just messaged you a picture I took from my back porch.
Oh, man. Am I going to look at this live? Oh, that is so cool. Gosh. Oh, And the camera's probably brightening it up a little bit because it felt like
dark.
Yeah, it felt. I've seen real pictures without like any, what is it, white?
So
yeah, all that, all the automatic things. And it goes, oh yeah, that's pitch black.
It was quite dark. So all the kids in the neighborhood were out running around, bouncing balls in the street. No cars were driving. Everybody was just hanging out. Everybody was out just sitting in chairs. I had a glass of wine. I was just hanging out on the back porch. And then it just got dark.
Gosh, and is that a star or a planet in the just to the bottom right of the sun?
I think so.
If you zoom in. Oh man. Oh, gosh. There's a plane in the sky.
Yeah. And that wasn't my nice camera. I just took a picture with my iPhone.
Yeah. Oh man.
It was very fun. I was really glad to have made it home. And our area, Bloomington, Ellettsville, it had been bracing for a huge influx of visitors.
Okay.
Like, everybody on the no.
Oh, okay.
Right. It significantly underperformed predictions in terms of overall number of visitors. They were telling us to expect up to 300,000 additional people in the county.
Okay.
And they were concerned about gas supply and grocery stores and all this stuff. And a bunch of my friends were on the police department, and basically everybody was called in on overtime to work that day.
Okay.
And they had fewer traffic accidents than on an average weekday.
Ah. It's interesting. Human behavior is wild.
Yeah. It's one of those things. If you warn everybody, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah.
Too busy. Can't get on the roads. Everybody stays home.
Yeah.
And then like you're driving around, like it felt like one of those weird zombie movies where like the guy, like 28 days later, the guy wakes up in the hospital and walks outside and London is empty.
Yeah.
Nobody there. And it's like,
there's two things that come to mind. So years ago in the LA area, they called it Carmageddon, where they were shutting down the 405, which is a major, it's like one of the busiest highways in the world, I'm convinced of it, where they had to demolish this bridge that crossed it. I think it was a Mulholland Road bridge. And they said, don't go anywhere. Don't get married on that Saturday. Don't, you know, it was between like a Saturday night and like a Monday morning or something. I can't remember the details now. But it was like there were no cars anywhere for dozens and dozens of miles. It was like there was no, humans overreacted to the warnings. Mm-hmm. The other thing is when I spoke last August, we actually had a hurricane warning here in Southern California. One of the tropical storms was going far north, more than expected, and it snuck through as it just dropped right under hurricane status, and it was a tropical storm. And it ended up causing everyone to get off the road. It caused everyone to fear, and just people were boarding up their windows with plywood. And we needed to be on the road to drive about 2.5 hours north on the 101 freeway, which is also kind of a heavy traveled freeway, especially on the weekends because it's along the coast. Lots of people doing their vacating. And it was like, it was a dream drive. It felt like days after the COVID shutdown where there is no one on the road. And I just go, the Buffett quote, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was making a societal decision based on that monetary thing. Where everyone was fearful, I'm like, yes, let's get out. Let's do something. Yeah, it rained and it's rained harder since. But how humanity reacted was just, it's fascinating. I think if there's sociologists that study this stuff, it blows me away. I love that type of stuff.
It's like that saying, when there's blood in the streets, buy property. When everyone's going one way, you can gain exponentially by going the other as long as you are smart about it.
Yeah, true. So, yeah. And last week we took our little vacation. I think when we started this podcast, we had just come off vacations, the two of us or something. You probably were upstate New York, but we headed to Palm Springs. That was really fun. A little R&R out there. I found the sweet spot. I think I talked about this in one of our first episodes where, you know, my honeymoon was 10 days. And by day 7, I'm like, I love this woman. It's a dream wife. But I got to get back to society. And so wrestling with that. So I feel like a 5 to 6 day trip close by, that's like the sweet spot. If we're going to fly someplace, I think it can be extended to 7 total days. But that fifth day, you start to get itchy. And we had stuff planned. We went on this really cool, like if anyone's in the Palm Springs area, there's this like a cable car, not a cable car, but like a gondola that goes from the valley floor up to the mountain. And it's about a 7,000 foot gain. And so you feel it, your ears are popping, and you feel a little bit winded when you hike around at the top. It's about 30 degrees colder. It's just fun. It's just one of those things that charges us up, especially after push from January 1st to April, May. There's no US holidays. So it is like you're just slugging out day after day. And about end of March, early April, I start to feel, everyone does. And so and the weather's changing. And so it's just really good to like get away. And so that's kind of our schedule. We are definitely going to pencil that in every year, this time of year.
Nice.
Yeah. It's really great. So
let's see what else is going on here. Mm-hmm. We have been making a lot of little lean improvements. I have not been able to get time on any one of my 3 Bamboo Labs printers consistently for the past 3 days.
That's amazing. That is freaking amazing.
And partly it's because, so we're in the process of remaking all of our 3D printed laser go, no go fixtures.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had over time, I'll post this on Instagram so mm-hmm. people can see the difference. We had designed a lot of laser fixtures that check locations of holes and slots in the overall profile of the part. And because you also need to quickly brush and vacuum off any residue or dust on the underside of the part.
Mm-hmm.
This was a dual purpose thing where you drop the part in face down, you're checking all the features, it holds the part still, and you can quickly brush it off and vacuum it in place and then put it in your good inspected clean bin. But we had just been taking those fixtures and screwing them down to pieces of plywood and then using quick grip clamps to attach them to the edge of the bench. So to change from fixture to fixture was kind of an awkward process. And some boards had 2 or 3 fixtures mounted to them, so you had to pick the right corner. And it was very kludgy.
Uh-huh.
It worked, but it was not elegant.
Uh-huh.
And so we wanted to find a way to have the fixtures be able to quickly snap on, snap off from some interface built into the bench so you could have tool-less quick change fixtures. So what we did at first was we put a couple of holes in the bench and then we put dowel pins in the underside of the fixture. But that required us to make the fixtures really thick
mm-hmm.
to have enough room to put a dowel pin in. And then they didn't stack nicely because they all had dowel pins sticking out of them in mm-hmm. weird places.
Yep.
And so we switched to a tapered interlock, a little 3D printed square with tapered sides. And then we're reprinting all the fixtures with a slightly thicker base and room for a matching cavity on the underside. So you just set them over this puck on the workbench. And they can't slide left or right, and they can't rotate. But you don't have to get us multiple points lined up. We don't have to worry about fitting in a multi-pin pattern.
Yep.
We just need this one locating feature in each fixture, pop it on there.
Yeah.
So Nick has been going through all the fixtures we have one at a time, updating them, thickening the bases, adding this locating geometry, and then reprinting them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit unusual because we have all of a sudden a big backlog of parts to be printed, which is normally not the case.
Yeah.
But several times in the past few days, I'm like, oh, I'm going to make a real quick thing for this or that. And I walk over, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
All 3 of our printers are tied up.
And you have X1 carbons, right? 3 X1 carbons?
Yep.
Yeah. Did you look at the other ones, the lesser ones?
Not really. I really want the standardization.
Yeah. I was just going to add the
same parts, the same nozzles, the same control interface, mm-hmm. the same AMS. I want the same everything.
Yep.
And we swap filaments fairly often. We have at least one carbon fiber spool loaded into each machine.
Mm-hmm. Each machine has an AMS?
Yeah, we've got 3 X1Cs with an AMS.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm considering buying a fourth one. Mm-hmm. It seems kind of goofy, but the reality of us using them continually, it's just like any machine you buy, it unlocks new capacity for you. It opens up the doors to be like, okay, I can quickly make a thing, print it off, have it in my hand, go test it, iterate it, and move on.
Yeah. I'm reaching over here for a big print. So I'm showing you a 3D print of our Max 4. Because mm-hmm. have you ever designed something and then it's not to the scale that you designed it in your head?
Mm-hmm.
And had you not, and call it 5 years ago, I've had a 3D printer for 13 or 14 years now, but I printed things, I go, oh, wow, no, this is not perceived. This is the right size. But now that I hold it, now that I put it on the table, this doesn't have the perception of being rigid. I've run all the math. I've done all the FEA, the material science stuff. I know it'll work, but it's not perceived. It doesn't look beefy enough. And that's one of the powerful things with 3D printing. You go, yeah, you just add in a little bit more beef and it feels acceptable to the soul, the machinist soul to be exact.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen interesting things. The value of being able to 3D print a part to make sure it's the size and shape and fits the way you want and looks the way you want.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen, I'm trying to think which shop it was. They were doing a lot of one-off car parts,
mm-hmm.
stuff where any individual customer who's going to use it is going to have who knows what other range of aftermarket parts in their engine.
Uh-huh.
And so they were 3D printing individual parts to be able to do a test assembly and verify all the clearances and tool access to get at the bolts and everything before they start machining the complex actual metal five-axis part.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a low-cost dummy check.
Right.
Let's take 3 hours and print this thing in a super low resolution, coarse, doesn't need to have stiff walls. It just needs to be the outside shape of the solid.
Uh-huh.
Make sure everything lines up.
Yeah, yeah.
Make sure we put the holes in the right place. Make sure we can get a wrench on every one of these bolt heads.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure there's enough clearance to actually locate this part in there and snake it in and line it up.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah. So one of my guys, Kyle, he's kind of run with the 3D printing in the shop. If anyone needs a fixture, he looks at it. He's pretty creative. So he prints a lot of stuff and he keeps the printer printing probably 20, 30 hours a week, I'd say on average. Mm-hmm. And I've told him it's to the point where I snapshot a picture of the file location in Fusion, and then I message him that snapshot and just say, print this. And lots of times he'll like ask, what's the quality requirement? To which most of the time it's just draft, because I'm literally you're going to bring it in, you're going to put it on my desk, I'm going to look at it for about under 10 seconds, I'm going to throw it in the trash, because it's just that easy. So the infill is very low, maybe two walls, maybe two to three walls. Just looks good. Great. Okay. Yeah. That's what I imagine. Trash. We keep going. That type of thing. But the fast prototyping today and fast prototyping 20 years ago looks radically different. It did mean no five-axis parts, multiple operations, 3 to 6 weeks, and thousands of dollars to put a part in your hand. You go, ugh, it's not the right size.
Yeah.
It's a great day and age to be living in.
Though the machines are expensive, the ability of five-axis to bridge that gap and go from a concept to an in-metal, fully functional part in your hand is incredible.
Oh, yeah. That's a great point. So a Bamboo X1 Carbon is a pricey. I'm going to say it's about $1,500 with the AMS, right? But that $1,500, people don't realize in the scope of what it takes to actually do product development, that it's almost free. It's almost free.
So. Use it 100 times
mm-hmm.
and it's free.
Yeah. So another thing, when you mentioned changes, we have our Pearson Progress chat and Signal company-wide chat. I ran across this improvement. Well, we use it for improvements or company highlights, but an ice cream truck broke down right in front of our shop, like could not move, was blocking spaces, and a few guys got some free ice cream. That was kind of a fun little serendipitous moment.
Eat it before it melts.
Yes. And to my comment, my dad joke was, the guy seems to have lost his cool. I'm sorry. Should throw that in there.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I know.
That's awful.
I'm glad that my guys got free ice cream. So
good. Yeah. So we're still not looking seriously at five axis as a thing to bring in the near future, just because for what we currently make, it hasn't been a pain point. I've been considering getting a second fourth. We've got a fourth on R650.
Okay.
And I've been thinking about getting a fourth to put on one of our Speedios, mm-hmm. just because I want the ability to have a production machine running a fourth and have the ability to prototype other things on a fourth, mm-hmm. without having to tie up a production machine to do that.
Sure.
And we change fixtures out relatively often on that Speedio. Mm-hmm. We have an MPS base on there, but we also have a vice on there, and stuff comes on and off fairly frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And having a fourth available for that machine would certainly make it easier. And as much as I like the R650, proving things out from the side door on a machine with a larger enclosure where you're looking down the wrong axis, it's weird.
Okay.
It's much less comfortable when I'm proving things and eyeballing clearances, the movements of that machine,
mm-hmm.
where it's going to go.
It's no longer a bird's eye view that us machinists are used to.
Yeah,
it's a cow's eye view.
I like standing at the front door of a three-axis mill with a fairly compact table and being able to see everything.
Yes, right.
And then being able to quickly just pause the machine and lean in and see kind of all the way around the thing.
Uh-huh.
I can get my head close enough to it. In the 650, if the spindle is at the other end of the table from the door, I can't see well. Even if I stop the machine and open the door and stick my head in, I can't see well.
Right. Yeah. I feel like if you were to have different levels of machining experience, you'd have like a beginner, intermediate, advanced. Like that's the type of stuff where that's like a super machinist where they can prove out stuff by looking at it from a different angle. Or like our horizontals, I think John Saunders refers it to looking at, it's the far side of the moon when you're working.
Yeah.
It's working on the far side of the tombstone. And it's just like for us in Fusion, we trust Fusion 100%. Wow. I can't believe I said that. 100%, like with the verticals.
We can edit it out.
Okay. No, with the verticals, but we take the same fixture and we just throw it on our horizontal pallet system. And the offsets are the same. We can hit cycle start and just trust it. And for the most part, Alex does. It still gives you pause. It's a factor. It's a comfort factor.
Yep.
That would have been a question that I would have asked. Hey, Andrew, I'm thinking of doing this like dual door, the brother that you have. How does it feel? Even though I'm not going to be running it. What's the experience? So
actually, another machinist sent me an email a couple months ago. And he's like, hey, we're thinking about getting an R650.
Okay.
What's your nitty gritty, had it for years, feedback on the machine? Uh-huh. What do you like? What do you not? And I just walked over to the machine and said, okay, imagine if I had this guy, his name was John. Mm-hmm. If I had John standing in my shop and I was going to answer his questions and point out what really stood out to me, what would I say?
Mm-hmm.
And then I walked around the machine once and talked to myself briefly and then got out my iPhone and just shot a 2-minute video and said, okay, here's a weird thing in the menu. Here's the thing about this setup. Here's the thing about this angle. Here's the thing about chip clearance. Whatever it was, the 650 is one of the things that stood out to me the most is it's weird to work from the side door and the angle at which you load tools in and out is awkward.
Oh, okay.
And if you don't get them lined up quite right in the chain,
okay,
when you try to load them in the spindle, it will pitch the tool down into the table. And I did that when I first got the machine. I was putting brand new tools in. When I was first tooling it up, I spiked a 3/8 chamfer mill straight down into the table and broke off the carbide tip in the table. And so there's still this little chip of carbide buried in the middle of that table from me just pitching that tool holder.
So break that down. Why does that happen? Because the tool was not fully engaged in the taper?
Yeah, the tool was not properly aligned. It was canted
out
a little bit. It didn't fully seat with the keys properly located in the carousel. Because on the Speedio, you're loading the tool holder is at an angle, but it's basically normal to you.
Okay.
On the 650, you're loading it off angle on all three axes. And there's nothing really to visually line it up. And after that first mistake, I was always, for the first year, I was paranoid about loading tools in and out of that machine. I'd load a tool in and I'd stand there and like tug on it and wiggle it and twist it. And then like very gingerly with the rapids turned down, manually load it into the spindle once to make sure. Because once it's been in the spindle and out, it's great. It's only that first tool load after you pop it in by hand that if you've gotten it in at a goofy angle, if it's not quite aligned right, problems.
So now there's no external loading capabilities, right? You have to load it at the spindle?
So you're not loading on Brothers, you don't load in and out of the spindle itself, at least not on the Speedio and R series machines. You have a tool load station, three to the side. So on Speedio, it's three left or three right is a load station. On the R's, because you can only access one side of the carousel, it's
three to the right.
It's three to the left on the 650, it's three to the right on the 450.
Got it.
Yeah. It's a marked station on the carousel. And when your pot is in that position, then you have clearance to push the tool holder out of it and swap it out.
Got it.
So you're loading in and out of the mechanical grippers in the carousel, but you're not engaging the spindle taper. So you can have the thing kind of clipped in and it'll hold and it'll move around in the carousel and not fall out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have it lined up properly, the spindle will just smack it out of your hand down to the table.
Okay.
Or smack it out of the gripper's hand down.
Sure.
To the
table. Yeah.
Only happened to me once on a 650 and once on a 450, but always makes me like, ooh.
Yeah. I'm thinking in terms of content. Like, that's a message that I've never heard on any type of social media content or YouTube, that type of thing. Do people know that? Like, is that widely known?
I've talked to other brother owners who have ours and they're like, yeah, you got to be careful loading tools.
Okay. All right.
Once you get the hang of it and you know what you're doing and you recognize that I have to just give it like one last twist, I lock it in, I make sure it clicks, I wiggle it, I twist it to make sure I'm seated on the keys. Great. Never had a problem since then. But coming off a machine where I didn't have to do that, when I was first tooling that machine up, I just snapped it in, it went clunk, I thought it was good, and then blam.
Wow. Okay. All right.
Yeah, excitement. Wow. I'm really glad I didn't like pitch a Renishaw probe straight into the table.
For sure.
Because I would have turned around and gotten sick right into the coolant sump.
Yeah,
would have been done for the day.
You said it was a chamfer mill, right?
Yep.
Okay, all right. So that's not that bad.
No, not an expensive tool.
Yeah.
But it made me sick at heart. Like, I just put this divot in the table of my new machine.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I think I mentioned on the last podcast or a previous podcast that just looking at more horizontals, looking at more, just more automation, that's where we need to go. And with that, so we bought our EC400 with 100 station tool changer because when it's your first machine, you should probably option it up. And we've had such gains with it that I think the next one we would only do like a 50 station and then probably ramp up some other options. Like I can't name off any off the top of my head, but then dedicated because right now you need 100 tools if you're switching between ferrous and non-ferrous. I think if we had a dedicated machine where, you know, this is the ferrous machine, that's the non-ferrous, great. We just do that. We just let her rip. And because chip management, not only chip management in the cut, but chip management in the scrap bins, it's an issue. We have to mark our scrap. We have to separate it. One time, the scrap guy came to me, hat in hand. He said, Jay, I owe you $600 for scrap. But, you know, the last time we came here, you said it was 60-61 and they acid tested it at the place and it wasn't. You gave us a barrel of mix. So I have to take that out of it. I said, dude, I get it. I'm sorry. We'll be more diligent. Just that hassle, that personal interaction. He was shaking and everything. I'm like, dude, I'm chill. It's good. I get it. It was just a mistake. We're not trying to rip you off. But that's the reality of mixed scrap. It almost has a human toll at times. Yeah. So I think we would standardize on the material that it cuts and the number of tools required.
So what you said is for your first machine, you should option it up.
I've switched.
And is that just that you can taste all the flavors of things you can do with that machine to really feel out what you want? Because I did that with my first Speedio. I optioned it up.
Uh-huh.
And the second Speedio, I optioned it all the way down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I would do. You know what? I wouldn't say if it's your first machine. If it's the first machine that you're getting into and here's everything we want to throw at it, it has to be a jack of all trades. It needs to be a Swiss Army knife. And so this one, yeah, because look, we have a grinder that we optioned way down, our first CNC grinder, and we just needed to, it was more like a proof of concept. My first lathe, we just need to enter turning. First bar feeder, give me the cheap Haas one. But no, I would say it's a more nuanced strategy behind that. Now that we know horizontals, now we know exactly what we need on the second one, and the second one will be optioned way down.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And certainly, if you don't have machining capabilities or accessories that you could use, it's hard to say, oh, I obviously would have used that and it would have worked. But if you have it, if you can afford to have it and try it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A really common thing in the Haas world is there's a saying, friends don't let friends buy VF1s. Because for $3,000 or $4,000 more.
That should be a shirt.
For a few thousand dollars more, you get a VF2 and it's got 10 extra inches of travel.
Yeah.
And you don't really buy a VF3 either. You just buy a VF4 because it's the same travel issues. And then, you know, the capabilities. And it's just there's a disproportionality between the cost and the capabilities. So
that's funny. I wonder how widely it's known, certainly from the machine tool seller side.
Mm-hmm.
They know which machines are the ones they sell in high volume, which ones are the best balance of value, weight, size, cost, capability, table space, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's a very different view of the industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, especially going back to the VF1-2 debate, it's the VF1 and the 2 take up the same floor space. There's no real reason, unless you're like, hey, this is a dedicated product or component that we're going to run. It's going to run lights. It's going to go just run. And that $3,000, we don't need to spend it. I would still spend it for pure resale value. Because right now we're sitting on a 2015 pre-NGC control side mount. No, I'm sorry. It's not side mount. It's 20 station umbrella tool changer that we go, we're going to get pennies for this darn thing. But my 2017 VF2 side mount tool changer probe, all that stuff, that sold right away and at a good price. And so, yeah, you just bite the bullet, you get the three extra grand out of your bank account, and you're going to earn that back at resale. So,
same thing with the Speedio series. They've got like the S500 and the S300, which are very compact machines.
Mm-hmm.
And they're almost the same price as the 700. And the 700 is the flagship. That's by far the one they sell the most of. It's the VF2 of the brother line.
Got it.
But I was wondering, like, why would somebody buy this, like, phone booth sized S300? And you're like, oh, well, if you have parts that you're going to run perpetually on that machine and that's all the space you need, mm-hmm. you can fit like three of these mm-hmm. in the space that you can fit one 700 or one S1000 and 31,000 in.
Well, that's a compelling reason.
And if you have a factory and you've got limited floor space, but you have enough work to afford the high density of machines, mm-hmm. then you don't care that it costs almost as much as the bigger one. Like, I like driving a small car.
Right.
I could have gotten a larger car for the same amount of money, mm-hmm. but it'd be harder to park and it'd burn up more gas.
There you go.
And for what I'm doing, I like what I have.
Yeah. You still like your car?
Oh, I have so much fun with my car.
Good. Gosh.
It is fun to drive every day.
Wow. This is my literal five-year anniversary of having my Model 3, and it still feels like year one, maybe one and a half. It's just, when you get a car that you like, you just, yeah.
10 days with my new wife on our honeymoon, too long. 5 years with my Tesla Model 3, like our first date.
Yeah. I put in a reservation for a Cybertruck. It's $100, cancel anytime. I just want to reserve my spot in line, but I don't think I can do it. Could you drive a Cybertruck?
No.
Yeah. See, I have an F-150. It's a company vehicle. I really like it. I just like the F-150.
I've got an F-250. It's our company vehicle, and I don't enjoy driving it.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, especially after your little yellow rocket.
Yeah. It's just, rocket. It's big. I'm far off the ground. Everything feels kind of loose and floppy, and it just, it's long. I'm always like, man, am I going to back into something? Like, I've double checked. I've checked my mirrors, but I still feel like the back end of this truck is so far away that I have no idea what's going on with it.
Yeah. What do you guys use it for?
Hauling scrap, picking up lumber, moving equipment around, anything we need to have a truck for.
Yeah.
Most of our employees are just driving sedans.
Okay.
And so having a vehicle that we can use from the shop to go run any errand that requires a pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, we relied on a couple employees who had pickup trucks, mm-hmm. but it's not a good use of their time. It makes a complication for reimbursement. It's just like, way easier to just buy a shop truck, mm-hmm. keep it gassed up, keep it here at the building. And anytime we need to do anything that needs a pickup truck,
mm-hmm. yeah,
ta-da.
It's not great business practice either. When you get into the insurance aspect of it and covering, you can have like insurance for non-owned vehicles. That's actually, we have a policy that covers that as well. Because my guys, they like to leave about 15 minutes early if they're on their way home. Like, for example, we don't have a daily DHL pickup. We do maybe mm-hmm. 3 to 5 DHL packages per week. It's not worth it. So one guy that lives at the other side of town, there's a drop off. He's tickled pink to leave 15, 20 minutes early and just drop off, and we comp him for it and everything. But it is, if there were an incident, it's not a great practice to have employees use their vehicles. So
two things I want to get to real quick.
Sure.
I know you got to run.
Yeah.
First one was, you mentioned price gouging around the Eclipse. Yeah. I was in Dallas and rental cars were absurd.
Really?
I didn't rent a car, but like, rental cars for 4 days were going to be like $800.
Oh my gosh.
It was insane.
Yeah.
My friend Rhett had an unbelievable hack. He flew into Dallas, he Ubered, and then rented a U-Haul truck. And for the entire weekend, he spent $165. But he had to drive a U-Haul truck.
Yeah.
So that was his rental car for the weekend. He was there for the same conference. And he's just driving around. It was more like a Sprinter van.
Okay. Sure.
It wasn't like a full-size U-Haul moving truck.
Right.
But it was one of those, like, you can rent it from Home Depot. It's like $20-$25 a day plus a fuel surcharge plus if you drive it over a certain number of miles or a certain number of days, there's this extra charge. He came out under $200 for the entire weekend.
That's so good.
Driving a U-Haul truck. He's like, if I had thought it, I probably could have just brought camping gear and slept in the back of this and not even had to have a hotel.
That's what I thought you were going to say next. Like, he just roughed it.
I don't think he did. I'm not sure. I don't think he did.
Okay.
Because if he had that much foresight and packed camping gear, that'd be amazing. But flying with camping gear is a bit of a chore.
Well, you'd be so far ahead of it. You could just go to Walmart, buy an air mattress and throw it away.
And give it away. Totally could.
Still be ahead of it. Yeah.
So I thought that was an astonishingly clever piece of negotiating around the market. Where is an undervalued vehicle that's available for short-term rental with few strings attached that will get me from A to B?
Yeah.
It's not going to be fancy. It's not a BMW, but it'll get me where I need to go.
Yeah.
I thought that was an outstanding thing. I got from Ryan Tierney at Lean Made Simple at Seating Matters, a copy of some of the posters they have in their shop of lean phrases and lean vocabulary.
Oh, cool.
And I was going through it this morning because we're in the process of handing off morning meetings. So I've created a template for how morning meetings are going to go, what portions are going to include. And we're going to start having not every meeting every day. We're not going to hand off 100% of them, but like twice a week, we're going to have an employee run meeting and gradually do it 3 days a week and then 4 days. And then eventually I'll run meetings only occasionally. But there were actually some lean phrases on their list that I don't like, didn't agree with. And I wanted to run this one by you because I pointed it out in the morning meeting today.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Which was proceed with an extreme sense of urgency.
Okay. If you didn't say that you didn't like it, my immediate reaction was that I would say it needs clarification because Ryan Tierney is a lean resource. I totally respect him.
Yes.
I wouldn't say I don't like that. But if someone else said it, a lean noob, I don't like it. Is there an explanation?
It's just in a list of lean phrases. And I like a lot of the other ones on the list. One other one that I thought was really great that we talked about also in the meeting was work as if the customer is watching you. And what I like about that one is...
Oh, you do like it. I like it too.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah, okay.
No, I do like that one. So it's not that I look at the list and go, I don't like any of these, but that one of particular part of an extreme sense of urgency. Uh-huh. For me, an extreme sense of urgency is reserved for times when there is either an outstanding opportunity available or there is a significant danger, risk. Like, I don't want to live with my workday tuned up to a level of an extreme sense of urgency.
Yeah.
I want to have a calm level of focus with the ability to hammer down if I need to. And opportunities arise. We've had some wild opportunities show up in the past few weeks that I will tell you more about in coming weeks.
Eventually, yes.
But the willingness to move large amounts of money around and take advantage of new opportunities that you didn't even think about, that all of a sudden they appear and you look at it and go, I can do that, but I have to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have the option to wait 6 months and think about that. I can either do it right now or I pass on it and forever hold my peace.
Right. Yeah.
And that is an interesting place to be, but I don't want that sense of extreme urgency to be and I don't want my car to idle at 5,000 RPM.
Yeah. That one would not be introduced here for a few reasons. I just pulled up our mission, vision, values doc that we include in every morning meeting. So one of the things is safety, quality, simplicity, speed. That's a call to speed. Not that you don't pursue speed, but you don't elevate it above safety, quality, or simplicity. Yep. The other thing, the second one, work as if the customer is watching. We have 10 characteristics that we talk about that helps shape the ideal teammate. And one of them is excellence, aiming to do our best work when no one is watching. So they're kind of synonymous, but they come at it from different angles.
Yeah.
That's where you get the temptation to slack or hide mistakes or bury processes or take shortcuts, but aiming to do our best work when no one is watching. So it's saying the same thing, just from different angles.
Imagining the customer is watching is not an attempt to sort of proxy, like pretend the boss is watching.
Yeah, right.
It's along the same lines as Paul Akers saying, always be tour ready, like always be willing to show somebody your shop.
Uh-huh.
If company comes over and you show them your house without having cleaned it and it looks good, it's clean.
Yeah.
If company comes over and you are like kicking the closet door to get it to shut because it's piled to the ceiling with all the stuff from everywhere you just jammed in there.
Sure.
Yeah, the house might look okay when the company comes, but they're going to leave and then that door's going to fall off its hinges.
Right.
And I want to find, there's a lot of lean ideas out there. There's lots of lean concepts. There's lots of lean principles. And many of them are distillations or derivatives of even more core ideas.
Yeah, as they should be. Lean should be flexible.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the particular implementation or the style and the feel of them will change from company to company. I thought it was really funny from Suzuki this week. He said, inventory is the root of all evil. Yeah. I'm like, man, strong statement.
Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, for him, it's the danger number one. When a company has excess inventory spread throughout the organization, every other problem that you need to solve is concealed under that layer of extra inventory.
Yeah.
And until you drain that swamp, you can't see where the problems are.
Yeah. I'm not going to push back on that because I'm obviously going to default to him being the better lean master. But I would say that overproduction, we always keep that as the top thing because that leads to excess inventory. Has he broken that down?
So in the context of that paragraph, he says, with regard to problems, just-in-time production or the lean manufacturing concept emphasizes that inventory is the root of all evil, covering problems and preventing us from making continuous improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So as we try to reduce inventory by reducing lot size or by other means, we uncover and address problems accordingly. Then we keep reducing inventory, mm-hmm. uncovering more problems and addressing them until we eliminate waste from the shop floor. While this process may be somewhat painful, it will help the company to focus its efforts in a pragmatic fashion and develop a streamlined operation.
Okay.
So obviously, I think he would be looking at overproduction and excess inventory as two sides of the same coin. You don't have one without the other.
Sure. Yeah.
Excess inventory doesn't just appear and overproduction doesn't just go nowhere.
Yeah. Well, looking at our mission, vision, values document. So this is what I've written for overproduction or overpurchasing, making or buying more than is needed. This is the king of all wastes, which takes more time. There's waiting, takes more space, excess inventory, costs more to move, transportation, is more likely to hide problems, defects, which causes rework, overprocessing, which requires a non-optimized process, wasted motion. So there's mm-hmm. six right there.
Yeah.
That is a yeah. byproduct of overproduction. But
yep.
Yeah. Well, I got to run. This is a great discussion. Yep. We should save
Thank
more
you.
Of it for next time.
I'll have some more lean improvements to show off, and I'm going to post some pictures on Instagram of those things we've been 3D printing that Nick's been working on.
Awesome. So very exciting.
I'll talk to you next week.
All right.
Thanks.
See you, Andrew.